It is Saturday, August 14th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me are geeks. Miles Elam, he's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We have Al Luckow, new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Good morning, everybody.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy and sometimes Stanford instructor.
Good morning, Ben. Good morning. How's it going?
Quite well. Miles, thanks for doing the show last week. I had a pleasure listening to it. It was a lot of fun.
I'm actually thinking I might just usurp your position. It's kind
all
of
right.
Fun.
All right. Well, arm wrestle for that.
That could be fun. Yeah.
I only ever do the show like once every 3 or 4 months. Yeah, and so I never have any time to get better at it. I just regress and get back to making the same mistakes over and over again.
That's my trick. You just repeat, 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 and eventually something sticks. That's okay. I thought you did really well. So listen, if you didn't hear last week's episode of Geek Speak and you don't listen to the podcast in general, go up to iTunes and subscribe to Geek Speak and listen to the podcast and fight some of the negative critique we had recently. Recently, we've had all these wonderful ratings on iTunes, right? And recently, and I don't know why I looked, two people gave us ones in star ratings.
Oh,
right?
That was me.
Oh, you jerk. Anyway, if you listen and like Geek Speak, or at least if you like it, go up to iTunes and give us a review.
It's because we badmouth homeopathy, wasn't it?
It was.
Probably was.
One of them was. The other was that I spoke about logarithmic numbering systems, I guess, unintelligently. And so we got a critique on that, which is true. I don't know what I'm talking about half the time. Unfortunately, this person clearly knew what it was. And instead of sharing that so we could share it with the audience, he kind of said some things that referenced that we didn't know what we were talking about, which is totally true. No argument there. But if you know something better than what we do, please participate by telling us. Call us up. We have phone numbers. We have email. We love to get user listener feedback and improve the show. It's one of those wonderful things we have because we have live radio. We can ask the live audience to participate. So please do so. The other one was being closed-minded about homeopathy and in general being closed-minded. And I just want to be really clear that I perceive the best way to be open-minded is to use the scientific principle and the scientific method of study. If you don't do it that way, you're just fighting ideology, and there's nobody that's correct. And therefore, I can say there's a
listen to the show
right
2 weeks ago.
exactly.
Because we talked about the issue of bias.
All right, was there anything from last week we wanted to touch on? Any corrections or anything?
Oh, I just had a quick follow-up, which is a new study which says that apparently the video. So we were talking about 3D glasses and whether the technology for 3D glasses really actually matters. Do we really need it? Is it really important to get it into people's homes? Is it important to get it in movie theaters? And we kind of had a discussion about that. You should listen to the show last week if you want to hear about that. But some recent research from Rice University's Department of Psychology found that if you enjoy what you're watching, the video quality doesn't actually matter as much. And they were particularly looking at compression, so very compressed video versus not very, well compressed video, higher bit rates versus lower bit rates. And they found that people don't detect the video quality differences nearly as much when they're enjoying what they're watching versus when they're not enjoying. So that kind of would back up, I think, the argument I would make, which is if you produce good content, it doesn't really matter if it's HD versus SD. It doesn't really matter if it's 3D versus 2D, as long as the content is good and entertaining and interesting. So
then adding 3D to a movie, if you add 3D to a movie that sucks to begin with, it doesn't make it any better.
Yeah, did anyone see A Christmas Carol, the new Disney movie that came out? Oh, God. It was...
No, Ben, we're adults.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, I got free tickets.
It was,
I thought,
like, a bargain.
I thought, okay, yeah. Someone, like, a company emailed me. It was like, come to the Dolby screening room in San Francisco to see a live or a premiere of the 3D version of movie. I didn't think, oh, Christmas Carol story's been done a million times. It's just recycled and it's 3D and it's Disney, so it's probably not good Disney 3D. And Dolby screening room sounds pretty good. So I went,
so
and
they
lost
they
many got, brain cells.
They got you by the geek angle.
They did. They did. Really did. And mm-hmm. it just frustrated me. But I learned about circular polarized lenses, which is kind of cool.
That's always a good thing to know about.
First time, yeah.
That was fun and entertaining. Thank you. Let's be a little bit more morbid, Al.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. There's a guy who has patented a screw-in coffin.
Well, it's about time.
Yes, it's a...
Wait. Does that mean that when your end comes, you really are screwed?
Well, screw it. You're dead anyway.
This episode is Miles puns.
Actually, it wasn't really a setup. It's true. Okay. This is a real thing.
Wait, like a light bulb?
I mean, it's you basically screw it directly into the ground, and it's got like a little round marker on the top. He has a little round marker on the top. So basically, you would just have this tube in the ground, and your body goes in the screw thing, and it's. I guess that you probably need a couple of guys to screw the thing in.
Need like a really big screw gun.
Or one of those really big, giant, you know, yeah, drills.
In fairness, it does look like a wood screw rather than a metal screw.
Yeah, it doesn't have
that pointed tip threads. To help you get it down in mm-hmm. there.
Well, it says that the coffins greatly reduce the excavation labor and yeah. burial costs. And the amount of space that it takes up, I mean, it's straight down, you know. I
thought anybody here used that. Well, Miles, we did the post-hole digging, those machines. Mm-hmm. It's like one of those, right? Does it pull the dirt out of the way, or does it push the dirt out of the way?
It doesn't have the wide blades that an auger has.
Right.
It really does look more like a wood screw. Like you have.
Okay. How do you get the dirt? Where does the dirt go? Because you're gonna.
The dirt is going to go up just like you're
okay,
right. Just
it's
like
gonna
an
pull
auger.
The dirt
yeah.
up. Yeah.
So it's going to take up the same amount of space as a normal coffin. It's just a matter of.
It's
the,
vertically.
The putting it in is the same process as digging up.
See, that's a really cool idea, because also you could then put a longer shaft on it, get it deeper and deeper, but with a small diameter, you know, rod that you kind of clamp on. And when you release yeah. that, it's already underground.
Yeah, I hate to...
Or you could put them under pressure somehow. Just...
Yeah.
Boing, you know.
Nice spring.
Have them pop up.
I hate to be a killjoy in an already morbid conversation, but...
Oh, please do.
Considering human populations, like... How much space do we really have for burying everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Well, true. I mean, there's a lot more echo ways. You know, you can go through, you know, cremation and stuff. There's even another thing.
Well, not if you're Catholic.
Well, you'd have to get past those things. But there's another thing called an echo pod, which I was mentioning. I was going to bring it up a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. That is basically it's a coffin made out of recycled newspapers.
Nice.
And they create them since they have the ability to mold these things. They can make really cool shapes. Like the one they have as an example looks like the one that they sent Spock out into space in.
Oh, cool.
The torpedo tube.
That torpedo thing. And so, you know, and so they have all these neat surfaces, and you can, you know, do all sorts of printing on them and stuff like that. And I guess people could sign them and stuff. So it's like it's basically a recycled newspaper coffin.
Okay, so the thing is, isn't the whole coffin idea that you want to kind of, I don't know, entomb the body with some giant respect
yes.
and dignity?
You can go visit
and
it.
And screwing someone to the ground doesn't seem very
yeah,
dignified.
Yeah, it'd make you really dizzy, and you end up standing instead of lying down.
See, I was actually thinking when you cremate someone, the person is how they look, and then you have them on your mantle or you spread them out onto your property or whatever.
Yeah.
And if you put someone into a coffin and bury them, it means that you're going, okay, I'm going to have this person totally decompose and all.
So you envision
all that,
rotting and all that.
But I don't want to have to see it.
Let's put it in the ground.
Well, okay, I know we're going to get a whole bunch of just
I
like,
know.
You know.
Man, we're well, the thing is, yeah, just a bad,
I think
just
I want to make sure I mention the guy's name is Donald Scruggs, who invented this thing.
All right, cool.
So, you know, and
he's
I have
the guy.
I have sort of an ancillary kind of little story here. This is, you know, we talked about memes before. Memes are things that go viral on the internet. We've seen all different kinds of things, you know, Rick Rowling.
Like bad video of dogs using skateboards.
Skateboards, all that kind of stuff. You know, people post and then millions of people look at it. Well, there's one going around, and it's called the Playing Dead, Lying Down game, which I thought was kind of similar to this. And people photographed themselves in weird positions that looked like, you know, like laying on the stairs.
That's pretty morbid too.
Their head stuck in, you know, a rock, and just all these different things of them lying down. And then they're posting them to their Facebook, and they're putting it on YouTube and all that kind of stuff. I put a bunch of, I'm going to have a bunch of links to this on geekspeak.org after the show. But there's kind of some really funny ones.
I'm looking at Al's screen. Those are really crazy. I've seen some on Facebook, and they're very normal. But
yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that are sort of it's a meme, you know, going
just
around.
Saw one that with people on tree branches. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're funny, you know. So I don't know.
I kind of want to start a meme, which is I don't know if you can start a meme or if it just has to happen. You know, like the universe decides there's going to be a meme on laying down. But I was going to do a sleeping in public meme actually. So I took a bunch of pictures when I was over in Europe with a couple of friends where we were just sleeping in bizarre positions.
You know, Ben, like, that's almost the laziest idea I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's pretty much exactly like laying down in public. So yeah, I think I could pretty confidently say I started that one.
The laying dead in public one.
Laying dead in public?
Yeah, well, that's what these ones are.
Well, they're playing dead and lying down. There's actually two different memes that kind of collected together. The lying down meme was basically supposedly started in the UK by
friends. You lie face
by
down
friends.
With your arms on your sides, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that's a lying down game. And then the other one, the playing dead, supposedly started in Japan, and it's based on some cartoon character that lies down and dead a lot. I don't really understand, but they kind of merged together to form this big lying down, playing dead game.
All right.
So
thank you very much for that story about death and
no
and
problem.
Such. Miles, you have some political stuff we could talk about?
Yeah, sure. The Electronic Freedom Foundation is sending
an organization.
Yes, sending out an open letter to Verizon regarding a company called Etisalat. And I'm probably saying that wrong, but
it's a sellout.
Etisalat.
It's a company that's based in the United Arab Emirates.
Etisalat.
Etisalat. Okay.
What do they do?
You're saying to this to me like, as though you're an authority on
I know
the Arab
about.
Language.
I do this
names.
A lot.
The issue here is that they've been acting in a way that is contrary to what we expect for rules for SSL certificates.
Oh, well, first off,
SSL certificates are what we use for security, like for sending credit cards over the internet. It's a way to make sure that not only is your communication secure so that other people can't listen in, but also that who you're talking to is who they say they are. Like, whether or not you know to trust a person is one thing, but then once you know the person is who they say, but just knowing who they are is a big deal. It's
and
a big
an
deal to be able to know.
If this doesn't exist, you and I could, I could set up a Wi-Fi network at a coffee shop that actually go through my computer. And when you say, I want Bank of America, I'd say, I'm Bank of America. And then the company, the person could theoretically do a transaction with me, and I could get all their bank record information if I spoofed it enough. Mm-hmm. So this is that layer that kind of, well, this is part of what it can do, is that I'd have to get a signed certificate that said I was bankofamerica.com, which I'm not going to be able to get unless I use one of these authoritative places that sign. And the issue is that this company is not doing it
well,
correctly?
Actually, yes, they're not doing it correctly, but it's a side issue with the fact that certificates guard against that. You know who you are talking to. But it is a level of trust. You always have to trust at a certain point. In other words, we would have to trust VeriSign to say, yes, that is in fact Amazon.com.
Right.
You don't have to trust Amazon.com, but you do have to trust VeriSign because they're the ones who gave out the certificate that you're checking against. It's kind of like with a driver's license. You have to trust the state of California that they're giving out an identification
valid
for
identification,
you
yeah.
rather than some random business card. The issue here is that Verizon gave out a certificate to this company, Etisalat, that but it isn't just a single certificate. It allows them to issue certificates. They're added as a proxy authority. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And by extension, they're saying, yes, Verizon, you can trust us. And we're saying that you can trust them, too. Unfortunately, their track record isn't so good. They actually signed stuff as Research in Motion and pushed out new firmware to BlackBerry owners that had malware on it that allowed them to surveil people's BlackBerries. And the justification they gave to that was, we can't allow these devices out there that don't have any ability for us to look in and have any judicial oversight over.
This brings out a really complicated, I mean, this is a very complicated process in the sense that the way that we do trust is very reliant upon, chain of effect trust. Because you don't do it that way. You know, your Mozilla browser, your Firefox browser, or any of your browsers, trust a certain amount of signers and says, if these are signed by these groups, we're good. And if each one of those are playing really good rules and only give certificates away in a certain way, then everything works. But once they give the rights to Joe Schmo to do something, and Joe Schmo does something unknown, then all of a sudden you can't trust your browser. And that's a scary process. Right? That's why we have to be so strict about it.
For an end user, like if you talk about eBay, if you talk about Amazon, they don't have the right to be able to just create any certificate.
Right.
They don't have the ability to say, I'm Bank of America now. They only have the ability to say, I'm eBay, and here's www.ebay, here is cgi.ebay, here's images.ebay, just things within the eBay domain. Once you start, there is the ability to give out certificates for a much wider variance, which what they've done here. And there you need to have a much stronger level of trust.
So
the thing
so
is that no browser or mobile device can block Etisalat without blocking Verizon, because their certificate is signed by Verizon. That's
gotcha.
That trust relationship.
Gotcha.
So Verizon has to invalidate their certificate, which is what the Electronic Freedom Foundation is asking them to do in an open letter.
Okay, interesting. Why is the Electronic Freedom Foundation doing this? It seems like an antitrust issue. It seems like a more serious thing than a nonprofit in the United States. Well, an international nonprofit.
Well, that's the thing, though.
Does
the
U.S. government does this?
Does the U.S. government have jurisdiction here? This is not an ICANN issue because it's not about a domain. It's about certificates.
Yeah.
It's not about a VeriSign because it's not going through VeriSign. It's going through Verizon.
It's pretty cool. Thank you for telling us this. I hope that the Verizon listens to EFF. I'm assuming it won't, unfortunately. But
I don't know, because this is a black eye, and a lot of folks are talking about removing VeriSign certificate from their trusted list to get past this issue.
The trusted list we're talking about would be in the browsers that you download.
Right. When you download a browser, there's a list that you can add them yourself if you want.
Right.
But there are ones that are set up for you automatically so that you don't have to know about this.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and do a story. Miles, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and do a story that I heard about, which I think is pretty funny. I think I heard it about it on NPR. But Google cracks the Rubik's Cube. So what a group of researchers did, and I don't have all the information in front of me, unfortunately, because I'm also hosting. I have no time to read. Morley Davidson, a professor of mathematics at Ohio's Kent State University, worked alongside some engineers at Google to calculate all the possible permutations of a Rubik's Cube, every location, every square that it could be in. There's a lot of permutations of a – like if you looked at the Rubik's Cube and said there's one and
it is the topic of many a math major's thesis to get out of undergrad.
And I'm trying to – let's see. It's 1, 2, 3. Let's see. Thousands, millions, billions, trillions, gillions?
Quadrillions.
Quadrillions. What's above that?
Quintillions.
Quintillions.
So 43 quintillion combinations and change. There's a lot of change. A lot of different settings. So then they crank through that and said, well, of that – how many moves does it take? What's the minimum move set does it take to get to the solve? And they prove that it's never more complex than 20 moves. So anytime you pick up a Rubik's Cube, you could make 20 moves and solve it. Now, it's a mathematical study they did, not the solution study, right? So it's just algorithmically, that's a truth. That's true. They've proved the truth that if you whatever presenting you have it, you can 20 moves and it can be solved.
Actually, do you want to take a moment to describe what a mathematical proof is?
Yeah, you do it. Why don't you go ahead and prove
I was having a really hard time doing this for a professor I had at UCSC, actually.
Not a mathematics professor.
Because it's something that people don't understand with mathematical proofs is that if the proof is valid, it's unassailable.
Right.
It's not like there's any wiggle room.
Right.
It's like the Pythagorean theorem, the idea that the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the square of the other two sides. You know, a right triangle, a squared plus b squared equals c squared.
I'm not going to explain that, but let's go on.
Right, but it's enough that if you've had geometry, you've seen it before.
Right.
There are several proofs to that, actually, that go from different angles. But there's a proof to that so that you know that is absolutely true. There is no possibility of a right triangle that
doesn't
fit that.
That's why we call it a proof. Right. So the basic principle of that is that you have some very basic fundamental math concepts which you accept on face value. addition and subtraction are examples of that. Mm-hmm. And without those, they are axioms.
Yeah,
they're axioms, and those are default true. Then, as you get more complex stuff, you can start writing a using only those axioms. You can start showing that if this is the case, and you're using this axiom, then this is the case. And you step through that entire process, you get to the solution. If you never have a logical error in that proof, then that proof, because it's based on the axioms without anything else, you know it's true. This is more
deductive reasoning.
Right. Yeah. I'm being really minimalistic on what we're actually talking about because it gets more complicated than that. But that's the general concept.
And someone who is a math major or has a PhD in math or the like can give us a quick, succinct definition of a mathematical proof that is accessible to the general public. We would love to hear it, and we'll read it on air.
I'm sure Wikipedia does a pretty good job of it. But in any case, the proof that they did with the Rubik's Cube, I'm assuming it's a proof. I actually haven't seen this proof, but they did this analysis. Doesn't actually show that what the solution of those 20 steps is. But if you could figure out the pattern and the solution out of that, you could theoretically pick up a Rubik's Cube, look at it, and solve it in 20 moves, which is kind of cool. All right, let's move on to the next story, which, is, of course, I'm supposed to point the fingers. See, Miles, you should have taken over today. Ben, what's up with Facebook?
Yeah, so it seems like every couple weeks we have a news story about Facebook and privacy. And I don't want to belabor the point, but there is a new bug with Facebook. And it's not a bug that you can fix by changing things in your privacy settings. It's no bug that you can do anything about to protect yourself.
So it's Facebook.
It's Facebook, yeah. Exactly. Oh, geez. So if you go into Facebook, I assume this bug hasn't been fixed yet. The news article was 2 days ago, and it said that they were quote unquote scrambling to fix the bug. Who knows if they actually fixed it? But the bug was that if you're a spammer and you want to harvest the names with the pictures, the little thumbnail pictures of Facebook users, you can do it, and it's easy, and it's totally fine. What happens is you enter in an email address, which is pretty, you pretty much enter anyone's email since almost everyone's on Facebook nowadays, right? You enter in an email address, it pops up and you type in an incorrect password, and it pops up with a page that says, sorry, you need to type in your password. And it has the full name and the picture on that page. So if you if you're a spammer, you had a long email list, you could just type all those in and get corresponding pictures and full names.
We're going to start seeing really good email. Which is a really good spam. I mean,
really
spam.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you could use the picture and you could use the full name to make a much more convincing spam message, right? That might get past spam filters.
Do you have to have an account on Facebook to do this?
No, you just go in and you try to log in as that person, you know. But you can fail because you don't know their password. But you can get their image and their.
Relatively soon you're going to see spam that has, if you have a Facebook account.
Assuming that people are taking advantage of this bug. I assume that some people are, but the question is whether or not those databases and everything, whether or not Facebook fixes it fast enough that it doesn't have a huge impact.
And now you've told the whole Central Coast, California this, it's going to happen automatically.
It was reported on PC World, so I mean,
So, I mean, this means that you might see messages actually, you know, sometimes you'll see spam messages to you, but it has your spam messages to you. It has your email prefix in there as your name.
Say right? Like hello Ben SJ at hello Ben SJ. I know that's spam because no one calls me Ben SJ.
I do. What's the SJ stand for?
My middle name and my last name.
Okay. So the basic idea is that the messages will actually be coming to your full name if you've got your name on Facebook and the email's there. And they might even show a picture of you as well.
Yeah, it's true. So that's bad. And a corresponding story to this, which doesn't actually involve Facebook, is a story I think might be overstepping what the study that it's reporting on says. But the headline of the story is loss of personal information is as stressful as losing a job, according to this article. Now, the research just basically asked people to rate the prospect of losing data, losing their job, losing their, you know, like not being able to provide healthcare to your family and things like that on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as stress, right? Mm-hmm. And they found that people actually would rate the prospect of losing data as extremely concerning, which is a rating of 8 out of 10. And they did the same kind of rating for losing a job. But the particularly interesting thing about this study is that it also asked, why don't why don't the people who are taking the study do things to do all the things that they can to protect themselves? And most of the Americans, 28% actually of the people who responded to the study, said that they lacked the information or knowledge, which was significantly higher than 5% who said they were too busy to take the extra step or they just didn't really care, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then 12% said online safety was too expensive. So that could be in terms of time or money. But still, it's interesting to see a study that says, according to it, more people are not doing what they can because they lack the information or knowledge. And I think that that's where geeks who are listening to Geek Speak and us, that's where our job is, you know, is to inform people on how to stay safe online. Because it's not because people don't care. It's more because they don't know how to, according to the study.
Makes sense. Well, thank you. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue, and online at SantaCruzElectronics.com. KOSP co-sponsors the Blue Ocean Film Festival Tuesday, August 24th through Sunday, August 29th, featuring more than 80 films taking viewers into the ocean and around the world, from big wave surfing to deep sea exploration, plus ocean-related events and activities throughout Monterey. Information is available at blueoceanfilmfestival.org. Today in the air with me is Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow. My name is Lyle Troxell. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. Anybody have a geek bit today?
I can always come up with a geek bit.
Why don't you make up a geek bit? Go for it.
There's a couple of neat applications, or one that I ran across that's kind of interesting on the web. It's a web app. It's called Juxio. And this thing will allow you to create these interesting collages of photos and captions. So you're able to, and this is a little bit difficult to describe on the radio, but you're able to drag pictures in, and then you drag another module on it, and it gives it a caption. But in a very graphical way, so you have a picture and then like a gray box next to it that's got a caption, and you can drag these different pictures in, and it creates this could be very big, could be small, could be five pictures, could be something that depicts an event, you know, our rafting trip, and then you just put this like stream of pictures in these rows, and then you can share this on Facebook, or you can email it, or there's a Twitter thing. It's another one of those kind of crazy internet ideas, you know.
It just shows up as a slideshow?
It's not. You can play it as a slideshow, but actually it doesn't end up being a slideshow. It ends up being sort of like a poster that allows you to kind of, you know, design your own, you know, it looks like a comic strip. Oops. Comic strip, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, you're able to share this thing, and then your Juxio, they call them Juxes, you save these on your account. You know, it's free.
This is really good, because it's very common that I'll be taking pictures of, like, something, and I want to kind of Facebook one of the pictures to friends. Mm. And I don't want to be sitting there uploading a whole bunch of pictures, right, to Facebook. I don't want to be pinging and spamming my friends on Facebook. So instead, I'm kind of in the situation where I have to pick one image for the day.
Yeah.
So this would be a way to say, you can add all those images in and just link that over.
And it becomes like one image, and it's you can tell a story with it. There's a bunch of examples in there. People have shown, you know, and you can take one picture and create artwork out of it. It's a neat idea, and it's free. It's in beta right now, but you can sign up, and it works, and I tried it, and I just did it just now. So it's a pretty neat little thing. It's at juxio.com.
Okay, cool.
So
thank you. I've got another geek bit, and I need a little second to look it up. The Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which it has an open house today, and it's free, and I think it's already open, so get down there. It's at Moss Landing. It's not down at the Monterey, the Moss Landing. And there's robots on display, the robots they use for exploration, the remotely operated vehicles. So I guess they're not robots because they're not automaton. No, I guess they are. Anyway, and it's a great hands-on, fun for the whole family. You can experience how the research is done at the Monterey Bay Area Research Institute. And it's at Moss Landing. And, you know, if you're on one and you're heading from Santa Cruz down to Monterey or from Monterey up to Santa Cruz, Moss Landing, of course, has the power plant. So it's an easy thing to see. And you're just turning west right at Moss Landing Road. And you'll see... and then Sandholt Road. But anyway, it's right over there. Take a look. Look up on geekspeak.org to find out more about it. I highly recommend it for a family event today if you're listening live. That's, of course, Saturday, the 14th of August. Well, I'm going to invite you to participate right now by calling us with questions and comments about technology. And the reason why we say questions and comments is, of course, we do appreciate your comments as well as your questions. If you want to correct us or add more information and insight to what we are talking about, we'd love for your help and excitement and interest in the show. And that goes above and beyond just calling in, which, of course, you can do so right now, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 476-2800, and that's in the 831 area code, 476-2800. You can ask us anything you'd like today, or 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also participate with GeekSpeak by giving us imagery and music for our show. We are Creative Commons Endeavor, which means that we give away our content after we produce it, which means you can do things with it if you'd like. And if you just participate by making a song, we'll play it as the theme song at least 1 week, and if we like it a lot, we'll hold on to it more. So, calls right now. We'll take questions and comments about anything about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
That reminds me, we did say that, you know, call us if you have corrections. And that it reminds me of this quote I used to have on my my little name plaque at Wheels of Zeus. It was, to be truly creative, one must lose their fear of being wrong.
Hmm.
So, if we didn't do this, you know, I mean, if we say wrong things, we're just trying to, you know.
Yes, that's good.
Keep the thing flowing. Tell us if we're wrong.
Yeah, then if we get corrected on air, that means that we can say that we are authoritative because we've been vetted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Very cool.
And then we blame Lyle, too, but that's another story.
Hey, Al, what's Boxy?
Boxy is a really cool interface that you can download. It's free, and it allows you to navigate the web, you know, YouTube videos and all that kind of stuff. And it's designed to make your computer look like a large screen TV. And actually, the UI is designed in such a way that it's meant to be viewed from a distance. So we call it a 10-foot UI. It's like the buttons are really big. And you can download Boxy and run it on your computer and then hook it directly to your HDTV or whatever. And you can navigate not only your own network of videos that you have on your own computer, but also all these content sources on the web. In addition to that, it has a free iPhone app that you can control it as a remote. So it's kind of like, you might have heard of Google TV and all these mm-hmm. things coming out, like TiVo, that kind of stuff. It kind of feels like that, but it's a really awesome looking UI, and it's all free. I guess the closest thing I can compare it to was Hulu, but it's not so commercially. You know, Hulu's very, you know, you're always watching commercials.
And Hulu, of course, is hosting content. Box is just an interface for content.
Right, right. So
I guess they probably host some stuff, too.
It's definitely a cool thing. Well, I'll put that link up on geekspeak.org as well after the show.
Thanks. Well, let's go ahead and start taking some calls. Nathan from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
How's it going?
Quite well. What's your question or comment today?
I wanted to know more about internet addiction and its relations to alcoholism and stuff like that, specifically recovery therefrom.
We can quit anytime we want.
Really? Yeah, it is classified theoretically as an addiction. You can be addicted to the internet.
Not in the DSM, though.
Not in the DSM, of course. Well,
means it isn't classified as an addiction.
Okay, but
theoretically.
It matches the patterns for addiction.
Yeah, it does.
I should say that. Do you have a problem yourself?
Half of my high school friends, I'm 25, said, I'm going to go play World of Warcraft, and I haven't heard from them since.
How long ago was that?
10 years ago.
Okay. That's not good.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of this one King of the Hill I saw where the father walks into a room, and there's this little guy in there, and it's one of his friend's sons, and he's all white and greenish, and he's got no hair, and he's just in front of his computer, and it's all dark in there, and he's like, oh! You know?
It's of course, I mean, to classify as an addiction, you have to say that your life is being altered negatively about this, right?
Yeah, if they stop doing it, do they have an adverse reaction as well?
Right, right. And so, and I've heard a little bit of debate about whether it's an addiction or not, right? And I would say that there's nothing. I mean, in some sense, if you're playing World of Warcraft, 10 or 12 hours a day, which is not uncommon for people that play, if they're able to pay their bills and function at some level, it's a judgment call on whether it's an addiction or not, right?
It's definitely a compulsive behavior.
I would agree. That's why I don't play video games anymore.
Actually, I don't play video. It's funny. I stopped playing video games predominantly because I learned how to program. Really? Like my gaming usage went down dramatically when I started learning how to make the stuff as opposed to just use it.
Unless you're doing a bad job, like we did at one point, and we were playing a lot of games at work. It's true.
I knew right away that I had I kind of grew up in the 80s when, you know, Space Invaders and all those things kind of come in. I always spent all my money at the arcades. And then when computers came and I started buying my computers, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to put games on my computer because they're going to be free once I get the game on there. And that's going to be what I do with my time. And I had to make a conscious effort to deny myself something that I knew I would have really enjoyed.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's a personal decision, I think. You have to decide
for
yourself.
I also think of compulsive shoppers, which is something that's also very damaging to your bank account and the like. And people are just like, no, but I have to, even because it's this self-rewarding behavior. It's like you go in, like, I got this thing and it makes me feel good.
Nathan, you called about internet addiction, and then you mentioned World of Warcraft, and we're all talking about games. We're not actually talking about internet addiction. We're talking about game addiction. I mean, I know that it uses the internet, but it's a little different in the sense that, I mean, internet addiction would be silly, right, because you'd just be looking at HTTP packets and other kind of packets. But what we're really talking about is the platforms on the internet. And aren't they different? I mean, looking at YouTube all the time is very or being in a chat room all the time or editing Wikipedia all the time. There's a lot of things you can be doing.
The need to check your email immediately when you wake up before you get up to go to the bathroom. It's that type of thing.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Well, I know with my experience, I spend more time on the internet when I have fewer things to do that could be productive. So the more content I can create, the more I can learn, the more things that I have that are interesting to read, the less I go on Facebook, the less I go on the internet, and certainly the less I play games as well. And I think maybe because I was always so interested in creating things with media growing up, I never really got into video games all that much. There were only a few that I actually played somewhat regularly, and even then not all that much time. So
I would also be careful if you were going to suggest to address internet addiction to use a reputable place, because of course there's a lot of money makers out on the internet, and that's a good one to target, right? So you probably want to go with a group that's been dealing with gambling addiction for a while, right? And then see if they have a program for internet addiction, because that way at least you know that they have a longer existence than
I've actually looked around, and the only ones that I can find for online addiction are online.
Yeah, of course.
That's funny.
Actually, that's not a bad thing, because that's how you're going to get the person to show up in the first place. One of the hardest parts about anybody who has a problem is getting them to show up for help.
Well, how many Alcohol Anonymous classes are held at the bar, you know?
You think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's the same rationale.
It's the same rationale, but it's different, though, I think, because it's a platform of
you like the internet
virtual
better than bars.
But No. Because you're in a virtual space, which is a world. I mean, they have things like Second Life, which are worlds in the internet, as opposed to a bar versus a living room versus, AAA or, you know,
I think you
or
definitely,
AA.
I think you're going to be treated for internet addiction. You definitely don't want to be in that line.
You could actually be in a bar in Second Life.
Yeah.
This is creating a paradox here.
I'm sorry that we are not addressing your question with the seriousness that it deserves, Nathan. I hope that we helped
you. No, it's fine. The goal of my call is just basically get more people talking about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a concern.
The one that I've seen the most about is the Center for Internet Addiction Recovery. That's just the one that is mentioned on Wikipedia, and I've seen occasionally here and there they're advocates for, I think they're advocates for getting it into the DSM.
Let's ask what Nephew Rick says. Nephew Rick?
Hey, actually, I recently came across this question myself when I was searching Facebook quite a bit. I use Facebook all the time, and so when I'm sitting around in school or I'm just in a restaurant hanging out waiting for friends to show up, I pull out my phone and I check Facebook. And what I realized is I think it has more to do with boredom, almost as if I have nothing else better to do or I haven't found anything else to do. So I check Facebook or I go online and check games. I think it has more to do with boredom than it does addiction.
That sounds like an addict.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. I mean, I do a lot of email checking. Like, I do check my email right when I wake up.
There's
but it's
also a social
moments.
Yeah, there's a social acceptance to that. Like, do you consider someone addicted to needlepoint when every free moment they have, they're going back to their needlepoint?
Right. It's a free moment versus...
It's not... I do think there is some merit to the fact that there is an obsessive aspect to our online mm-hmm. lives, which I don't think takes on the same level that, say, a needlepoint or crochet would. But there is some overlap there that I think does need to be recognized so that we don't get too hysterical about the issue.
Nathan, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye.
I think we should all just also just mention who nephew Rick is, because wouldn't it be cool if we could just like
nice and mystery.
Like any time we had something we weren't talking eloquently about, we could just say, "What does nephew Rick think?" And then a voice just comes on.
All right, next call. So, in Capitola, Bill, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I can't follow that.
Neither can we.
I'm curious about you were talking about security a little while ago, and you know. A little education on what's prudent for, say, a Mac user. We've got a DSL line coming from AT&T, and it's Yahoo, and they're scanning stuff that comes in. And then, should I have something extra on my computer?
When you say scanning stuff coming in, are you talking about you have an antivirus scanner on your system, or are you talking about you're doing packet sniffing and seeing all of the scanners that are out on the internet coming after people?
No, it's the ISP has some kind of a scanning. I sent myself a bunch of emails the other day, and I got a message from Yahoo that said this email had an attachment that we couldn't scan because our scanner was offline.
Mm. Okay, so email filtering. Okay.
Yeah, and so I as well as the internet.
And Yahoo did this?
Yeah, Yahoo.
Wow, that's nice.
Well, it's AT&T, Yahoo. I think they have some partnership there.
Right. It used to be SBC, Yahoo.
SBC, Yahoo. Yeah.
But does that mean that AT&T, your service provider, has anything to do with your email? I mean, I think that they might be completely different.
No, they do because they have a partnership with Yahoo. They're saving money by not having their own like SMTP servers and have to deal with all the email clients. They're giving everyone that web access.
Basically, everybody has you have a Yahoo email account. When you do this. And so your email provider is doing scanning. This has been in the business world for a long time, right? When you're doing a large business network, you do your own email servers, and you scan it and you check it and you're filtering it all the time. And it makes a lot of sense because you want to protect your whole network. And, of course, your staff's email accounts are a great way for new bad stuff to come in. But in the space of an ISP doing this, it's a little different because, of course, the decisions on what gets filtered or whether, you know, that choice right there of, you know, our scanner was offline, so you can't get this attachment. Well, that's a little silly, right? I mean, I've had the situation where I wanted to send a zip to somebody, and it's just a zip file, but the scanning software caught it as, well, we don't accept zips because there might be something compressed in there that's bad. So it denied it.
And then they needed to buy the software.
It didn't deny it. It just gave me a warning. It said,
it's not scanned. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
This has not been scanned. You know, you better know before you open.
There are viruses that Macintosh users can pass along. They're Word macro viruses. They can actually function. So that's one example. And then also attachments that even if you can't run it, you then forward it to somebody else, the other person could run it, right? So that's an executable. So to some degree, it makes sense for every user to get filtered in their email. But you are going to have some false positives sometimes, which will be frustrating when you run across them. The other thing that I find interesting here, and I don't think about spam very much anymore because I have all my email going through Gmail. And I would assume all of us do that at this point. Do all of you have your Gmail?
I don't.
But you do have a good spam solution already. Gmail's spam solution has gotten so good that I don't really think about spam very much. I don't get it very often.
Actually, I did have a spam caught or a false positive from Google, from a work address, actually, because the company goes through Gmail. Considering the fact that when I went into the spam folder and I was able to find that message and I saw that, and I've only been at this company for a month, that there were the better part of 1,000 messages in my spam folder.
That you didn't want.
I'm okay with that one false positive.
The thing is, though, that is if Yahoo and Gmail start doing the spam and virus checking, and they're like the authoritative answer and all of us use them, if they want to suppress a message accidentally or by on purpose, it would be relatively easy for them to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Not that I'm not trying to be paranoid here, but the other thing is to make your computer safe. Are you in a Mac or a Windows machine?
Mac.
Okay. You're pretty good. You don't have to do much. Sophos is something that's used a lot on Macs.
With a DSL or any broadband connection, you want to have a home gateway kit, the little box.
A router.
Although a lot of ISPs are delivering them now as part of your service. So,
yeah. The other thing is, on any machine, what you want to do is update the operating system. That's the primary thing to do. Update your operating system and the applications you use by keeping them up to date. On Windows, you set it up to automatically update and upgrade, and on Mac, you do the same thing. And then at least you won't be it's a rare chance to get hit, right? Lots of these vulnerabilities exist, and then people don't patch their systems, and then months later, someone takes advantage of it. And if you haven't patched your system in that place, you can get infected by it.
And the biggest things as a user is if you're web browsing and if you go to gambling sites, porn sites, things like those are probably your two biggest threat vectors. That if you're just browsing on the web, those can actually get into your system whether you have a Mac or a Windows box. Although most of the targets are for Windows, it's still possible for a Mac to get attacked by this.
And let me be really clear, and Alex is kind of prompting me, or something. California correspondent is prompting me to say, patch your system. Do not ignore updates. If you have an update pending on a Mac or Windows, do it. Don't delay. And the best way to do this, especially if you're on a dial-up or a slower connection because you're worried it's going to take a long time, start it before you go to bed and check it in the morning. If you don't patch that, you're asking yourself to be vulnerable to vectors into your computer, and you don't want that hassle. It's a pain.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah, big pain.
Hey, thanks so much for your call, Bill.
Thank you.
We have a couple more minutes left. I don't know if I should ask for more calls, because if we did that, we'd have to take them, and then we might not be able to get to them.
I've gotten a lot of different spams lately, actually. Yeah.
Anything interesting?
A lot from saying your Amazon thing is ready, and I've been recently getting a lot of LinkedIn. You know, hey, this Marla from Interbrand, she was a colleague of yours at Interbrand, wants to, you know, to you be your friend on LinkedIn. You click the thing. You know, if you hover over it, it'll say you can see immediately that it's like an executable.
Right.
You know, and so it's weird. It's like LinkedIn, you know, a lot of these things that, and they're very, very, you know, convincing. You know, I mean, even my wife had said, should I be doing anything with this? You know, she sent me this email, and it was literally an exact duplicate of the company. But, you know, you hover over the link for a second and it comes up and it's some like .ru or something like that. And there's just so many things right now that look very convincing.
I mean, you know, do a favor for yourself. Your financial institutions and stuff, don't, when you get your emails from them, don't click on the emails. Just go to the website and use a bookmark, right? Search, go to the actual domain name, type it in, and then bookmark that. And anytime you get an email from your bank saying, hey, something's wrong with your account, then you go and you log into your browser and you log into your bank, and it will tell you there.
Very good advice.
Click on the email. Yes. If you get used to that, someone's going to get you one day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Never, ever through the emails.
Yeah.
Ben, real quick, what's going on with kids and cartoons?
Kids are, oh, geez. Okay. So I wasn't prepared to, I moved that one down. But it turns out that there's some new research, and it's a relatively small sample size, so it's preliminary. I'm sure some other research is not on this, but apparently children's vegetable intake has been linked to watching, or not linked to, but is helped by watching Popeye cartoons.
I can vouch for that personally. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Both my kids love Popeye, and you know, you should see my little boy when we're having spinach. Oh, I'll have some of that spinach. I mean, it really.
Mm-hmm.
I actually remember it having that effect on me as well.
Yeah, but
once
me too.
I got past the the age of going, the spinach is really horrible and disgusting for a young child.
Kids, don't listen to Miles.
Yeah, it's really scary.
It is good. Spinach is good.
No, it is. If prepared correctly, it's really awesome.
I'm going to tell
Becky
you don't like
then
spinach.
I would make the same argument for Brussels sprouts.
Yes.
I don't know. What do you guys
awesome.
Say? If you cook them right, but if you cook them wrong, horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Okay. Yeah, if you cook anything wrong, it's horrible. Come on.
Oh, yeah, that's true. There's a smaller window.
Here's a filet mignon, and it's burnt. Yay!
Here's a filet mignon cooked well done.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Cooked at all. Yeah. All right. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence. We thank you. The Puppet Master for its use. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses. Tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and has been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. All the stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak and little notes and comments and all that stuff and recommendations about every show are up on our website, geekspeak.org. You just have to find the show date, and today's show date is August 14th, 2010. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Here is Al's crazy USB of the week.
Hi, this is Al Luckow with GeekSpeak's crazy USB device of the week. Hey guys and gals, with the cold summer we've been having here in Santa Cruz, a lot of us have stayed bundled up. Well, what does that make?
It makes a bunch of pasty-faced beach bingo babes with no tans. But don't let that get you down. If you're stuck in a cubicle all week, use that time to get a tan. You can show off on the cold, foggy weekend. Yep, all you need is the USB desktop tanning center. Just plug the two base units into your USB port and you're ready to roast. It's equipped with two 100-watt ultraviolet light bulbs. It comes with three settings, powder, tea, and malignant. Yep, you can't smoke at work anymore, but you can still do something stupid to give yourself cancer. So check out the USB desktop tanning center. Yes, it's real. The link is up on geekspeak.org.
How do you really feel that badly about sun tanning?
Oh, it's
bad for you.
If you have to go to a tanning booth, and I mean that's like
speaking. Yeah, that's of course someone speaking that lives in California.
Can't you just get like spray paint? I mean, they have like paint
tattoos.
You just get sprayed your whole body if you want to be tan. I mean, come on, you're just like it's like give me that cigarette. You know, it just feels very like obvious. Let's do something bad for ourselves. You know?
That's totally true.
Yay, radiation.
I'm not eating enough salt and sugar and fat and carcinogens. I need to do something else for my skin outside.
People are so concerned about radiation. You mentioned radiation kind of jokingly. But, of course, when I think of bad radiation, the first thing I think of is the sun because it's so ubiquitous. It's always happening, mm-hmm. and it's easy to get hurt by it, right?
Yep.
And you get radiation poisoning from it. Well, radiation burns.
There's almost nothing more ubiquitous than the sun. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
A cloudy day.
Have you ever looked up during the day and not seen the sun there?
Yes.
Well,
half the day.
You know what I meant.
Gosh, it's fun to tease
right.
Ben.
Yeah, it's very fun.
Hilarious.
You can tell I'm kind of stalling for time because I did that really fast.
Isn't there a meteor showers going on right now?
Yeah, the Perseid. I always pronounce this right.
Perseids.
So they peaked 2 days ago. That was on the 12th, August 12th. Was when the meteor count peaked. I think it peaked at like the article I read said 60 per minute. I don't know why they said. Or no, I'm sorry, 60 per hour. Per 60.
Is it 60 per minute?
Of course,
that's
we would
fast.
Know that.
Yeah,
we've been completely
hour,
covered
is.
In
hour,
yes. fog lately.
They should have said one per true. Minute instead of 60 per hour. I don't understand why they...
Because if you look at a minute, it won't be one.
But
if you look at an hour, you'll see about 60.
They were peaking around midnight. They go from 11 to 4 a.m. and
was it
cloud
pretty,
cover
has been
everywhere.
Absolute. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you need like a laser ray to get rid of the clouds or something?
That's August in Santa Cruz, I guess.
Really disappointing. Like stayed up
it
late.
It isn't usually.
Because
this was my anniversary. I remember when I got married, it was hot and sunny on this day 12 years ago.
Was today your anniversary?
Yep.
Happy anniversary.
Thanks.
And with that, we'll close the episode of Geek Speak. Coming up next is The Car Guys. Click and clack.